Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by former family barrister turned therapist and author, Charlotte Friedman. Charlotte's decision to move from the courtroom to the therapist couch was sparked by the desire to help people manage the emotional journey of divorce. In her book, Breaking Upwards, she offers calm, therapeutic advice on everything from managing loneliness to letting go of grievance. Charlotte is a trained psychodynamic psychotherapist, registered with the British Psychoanalytic Council and the Tavistock Society. She's also the founder of the Divorce Support Group, which has helped provide a community space for people trying to manage the emotional impact of divorce and separation. Today's episode is centered around loneliness. We begin by exploring what loneliness is, whether it's a physical or mental feeling or both, how loneliness links to grief, as well as the emotional journey of divorce and separation. We discuss seeking professional help and how children and other family members can sense and react to loneliness. Finally, Charlotte and I discuss coping mechanisms for loneliness, especially post-separation. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you.
So Charlotte, tell us a little bit about your professional background. So why did you choose to leave family law and retrain as a therapist?
Well, I was a family law barrister for 25 years, and the whole legal process around divorce is very, very acrimonious and very polarizing. And it's not really a very helpful process. At the end of it, you get your divorce. The state legally recognizes that you're divorced, but there are really no winners. I mean, I represented so many, whether it was men or women, and I might win their case for them, get them what they wanted, but they were never happy because you can have your divorce, but it actually doesn't help you feel any better. It's just one small step in the separation process. And I felt that actually it would be more helpful to approach this from the point of view of a psychotherapist and manage all the feelings around it, rather than a sort of very linear, concrete process called the divorce process in court.
And do you feel that you're adding something different with an emotional journey then? So you mentioned there that you're helping people, I suppose, resolve the issue of separation rather than complete a divorce. Just expand on that a little bit. What are people actually doing in that process with you?
Well, the separation process is all about facing loss and facing the end of something. And of course, the legal process is the legal aspect of that. But the real facing loss is the emotional aspect. And you really have to work through that. And it's about saying goodbye to something which has been, whether it's been a good relationship or a bad relationship, it's very painful losing something that's been part of your life. And that's the difficulty. So when people actually get their physical divorce, it's just the beginning of the process. It's not the end of it.
And what part of the process do you come in then? So are you working with people who are thinking about divorce or who have divorced? What sort of, typically, where do you come into their journeys?
At any point in that journey. So people can come, I mean, I see couples and I see individuals. So people can come and say, you know, I'm very unhappy in my relationship, but actually there's so much community around the relationship and we have children and I don't really want to divorce. And we can talk through that and, you know, think about whether there's a way of staying in the relationship. And people come when they've already made that decision and they've left or they've been left. So it's at all different parts of that spectrum.
And you mentioned there that you work with both couples and individuals. It must be quite different in those two scenarios, because I guess with an individual, you're only hearing kind of one side of the story. And with a couple, you've got
two narratives to try and understand, disentangle, and you've got to walk alongside both people. Tell me about the challenges of walking alongside both.
Well, it's obviously very important to be non-partisan, not to take one person's side over the other. What you're trying to do when you see a couple is, if a couple wants to stay together or separate in an amicable way, is to sort of co-create, to help them co-create something. So in a relationship, there's two individuals, but they're co-creating the relationship, the space between them. And that space between them is the entity called the relationship. And that's what you're trying to help them feed, if you like, rather than detract from it. When you have a couple who come because they want to try and separate in an amicable way, it's a completely different conversation. It's about how they manage to dismantle everything whilst maintaining a dialogue, usually as parents of their children.
Yeah, because that's certainly the most important thing that we focus on at Amicable, is trying to preserve that co-parenting relationship. And that can be very tricky when there's a lot of hurt, because obviously people get objectively that they'll need to maintain a relationship. But actually doing that practically when you are still, as you say, grieving a loss is quite tricky, isn't it? What has to happen for a person to accept that loss and be able to prioritize the sort of focusing on the longer term relationship right where they're stuck in that hurt? What sort of work do you do with them at that point?
It's a very, very difficult task for somebody, for all of us, very, very angry, to try and be collaborative and cooperative with the person you're the most angry with and you feel the most hurt by. And it's about being able to suspend those feelings. That doesn't mean not acknowledging them, not having them, but to suspend them and have them dealt with in an individual therapy or however people want to choose to deal with them, but to suspend them for the greater good, which is to co-parent for the children. So just seeing the other parent, your ex-partner, might be hugely provocative, even if words aren't exchanged. And it's about a real exercise, a sort of iron will exercise of saying, okay, I've got all these feelings. I'd like to be able to act out on them. I'd like to scream and shout or do whatever. But actually, I've just got to organize this for the sake of our children. And it is a very difficult task. I'm not underestimating how difficult that is. But if people can actually talk it through, if there's a space to talk about your feelings, a place you can bring your feelings and say how angry and upset and disappointed you are, then it makes that process of co-parenting much more likely as a possibility that it can happen successfully.
And by definition then, Charlotte, do you think that space has to be an individual space? Because to do that as a couple just feels like it could be quite destructive and it quite could spiral out of hand. And I know certainly when we're working with couples to do the practical side of a divorce, we are always trying to get them to suspend those angry feelings, but signposting them out to do some individual work. Is it individual work that ultimately is going to allow somebody to heal after the devastation of a breakup?
Yes, it is. It is an individual space. Because when you're separated, you know, you don't want to have any more conversation. You don't need to have your feelings heard by your ex-partner and acknowledged. I mean, of course, if you want to have a conversation about parenting, then that's part of that process a little bit. But the bulk of your feelings as a result of your separation have to be aired just for you. That it's no longer to be diluted by asking somebody who hasn't got your best interests at heart to understand them. You don't have to have them heard by the person who you're unhappy with. Yeah. It's in that therapy process, it's in that space of you, the therapist, and the individual that people can really explore how they feel and actually have a different perspective many times on what their relationship was like, or why they're feeling the way they do.
Mm. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because as you're talking about this, it feels to me like we're actually talking about learning to be an individual rather than a part of a couple, which is essentially part of what I wanted to explore with you today, this idea of you've been a couple, you're moving to that individual status. And sometimes there are feelings of loneliness that come with that. And changing that space from being a couple space to an individual, I guess loneliness is one of the key features of that, isn't it? Tell me a little bit about how that presents, how you see that in people who are having this kind of therapy.
Yeah, I can talk about loneliness, but it's interesting you ask about, you know, developing yourself as an individual, because often in relationships, especially relationships that aren't really very good ones, you lose your sense of self. And so when the partnership breaks up and you find yourself without the other person, you have no sense of self and you have no idea how to make decisions or what opinions you might have about something. You're just flooded with feeling. But the point about the therapy is to find your voice again and to find yourself. I'm not saying you always have to do that through therapy, but that's really what needs to be done, to find a sense of self. And just going now to your question about loneliness, there's a distinction between being alone, which you are when you're separated, and being lonely. And being alone is a sort of physical state. It's a physical state of being when no one else is there. Being lonely is a psychological state. It's a sort of existential state. It's about how you feel inside, within yourself, and you feel sad. And you can feel very lonely in a marriage, and you're not alone at all. You're with somebody. And there is nothing more painful than being with somebody who makes you feel lonely because there's no connection. And loneliness is about a loss of connection, and that isn't always with another human being. It's about a loss of connection with yourself. And a lot of people who separate feel lonely, but it's not because they're alone. It's because they've lost the connection with themselves and think that they're of no value and of no importance. So if you stay in on a Saturday night by yourself, which some people might think is wonderful, you can feel quite lonely if you don't have a feeling that you're worth it, that you're of value. And that's very important to build up after separation, because during the end of, you know, the death knell of a separation, which often takes months and years in terms of thinking, you know, you can forget who you are.
So what kind of work do you do with people then to try and get them to reconnect with themselves? What are the typical things you might cover? So if anyone's listening and they're feeling and they're recognizing what you're describing, that state of loneliness, whether it's aloneness or loneliness, then what would you work on with them? What are you asking them to do in those moments?
A lot of people think that if you do a lot of external looking for things, you might join a gym, or you might go running, or you might go on a sort of yoga holiday, whatever it is, that you're looking for the external to fill you up. Now, that's good. It's good to make connections with people, and it's good to do things that actually make you happy or make you things you enjoy to do. But what's really important is to work on these things from the inside out, because everything starts with you. And if you feel there's nothing inside you, doesn't matter how much external reassurance you get by somebody inviting you to the pub for a drink or whatever, you're still going to feel pretty empty inside when you get back home and you're on your own again. So the work is in really taking back the layers and understanding why people feel that they're not worth it, why spending an evening by yourself feels so empty and desolate. And I can't give a one size fits all. It often comes from childhood experiences about not being connected with, or absent mothers, or narcissistic mothers, or negligent carers, where you feel as a child that actually you're not worth it. And you carry that through life, and you mask it by your job, or by having friends, or by being very busy. But when the chips are down and you're left on your own after a relationship, that's when you get back in touch with that part of you that you feel is so much without value. And that's when the pain starts.
And it sounds like this is, you know, absolutely a key thing to go through, to work with, to work on, before transitioning into a new relationship. Is that fair enough, or is that idealistic?
I think that's a very good thing, that actually, of course, you can go and find, well, it's not that easy necessarily, but you can go and find another relationship. But if you haven't worked on this inside yourself, you are unconsciously, meaning without really realizing it, going to attract the same sort of person, and you're going to be on a repeat cycle. You think it's going to be different. Maybe he or she sort of seems different, but it will be the same, because you'll be attracting the same sort of person to reinforce the same atmosphere you had growing up, in a way. So, you know, dating can be distracting, and it can be exciting, and it can have its benefits. But to use separation as an opportunity to change and to be creative and to do something differently is to really work on yourself.
Well, that sounds like a real positive aspect of separation, because we get used to talking about breakups and separations in a very negative and downbeat way. They're unexpected. They're not something we want. But for some people, I guess, it's been something that they've been thinking about for a long time, and it marks the beginning of a new and positive journey. And it sounds to me, from what you're saying, is that even if that's not where you sort of formulated those thoughts, you didn't think of the separation in those terms in the initial part of it, perhaps you were the receiver of the news rather than the instigator, there is still every opportunity to turn it into something that positive and good can come out of, some self-investment to build. Is it self-esteem or self-confidence, or is it something different?
It's self-worth.
Self-worth.
Meaning that you have value and you are of value, and that you don't sell yourself short, and you don't abandon yourself for the needs of other people. A relationship is a democracy, it's a democratic state, meaning that your feelings are as important as the other person's feelings. And lots of people in relationships, and they kind of find this when they look back, is that they've sacrificed their feelings on the altar of the other person. As long as the other person's happy, as long as he or she feels okay, as long as I turn myself inside out to keep the peace, then it's all going to be all right.
Well, as I say, let me challenge that then, because if everybody's thinking that, then there's something that's not balancing, isn't there? Because if everybody's in the situation where they're thinking they're sacrificing their feelings.
Well, not everybody does. You see, one part of the couple often is not sacrificing their feelings, because they've hooked up with somebody who's doing all the work for them.
Yeah.
And so that's the perfect union for the person, you know, who's having their feelings met.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I get that. You've written a book, Charlotte. Tell us a little bit about the book, Breaking Upwards. What does that cover?
Well, that covers, hopefully, all the aspects of the emotional aspects of separating. And it covers how to manage the emotional aspects of separating. And it covers, you know, your community. When you separate, you usually have a community of friends, couples, friends, and how you lose that, how you navigate that, how friendships change. Some people stay loyal to you, some people don't. How you navigate the loss of that, because the loss of a relationship is more than just the two people. How you manage your children and their experience of your separation and your divorce. It's about loneliness. It's about feeling stuck, which is a huge thing that happens, where you cannot get over it. You just keep going over and over, if only I'd said this, if only I'd done that. And then you're not really separated, because you're still really, really connected with the other person. Or how you use the divorce process, the legal process, to kind of in some way stay connected. Or how you manage having found out that your partner had an affair and that's why the relationship is over. It covers all those feelings that happen as a result of separating.
And one of the things that we talk about when we talk about the emotional journey is kind of a mirror of the grief curve. And is it the same in your book? Are you effectively saying there's this kind of crisis point where you've got all the raw and angry feelings? You've then sort of dipped down into a lesser active state where it's depression, it's bargaining, it's, you know, trying to go, as you just said, over and over the things, and where you're quite stuck and you're sort of trolleying along the bottom a bit before you start to get into a place where you can start to resolve issues and think about options and possibilities before then sort of moving up and on with your life. Are you saying that there's a similar, from the sort of work that you do, have you found a similar kind of pattern that people follow?
Yes, it's a similar pattern, because all loss, whatever it's attributed to, is a sort of bereavement. And grief sort of follows that pattern. But what I would say is it's not linear. So, you know, one day or 1 hour, you can feel that you're accepting it. And then the next hour, you can just feel full of hate and that you don't accept it and you're very stuck and you're full of sadness. It's just not a linear process, and you can go back and forth and back and forth. And eventually, successful mourning, successful grieving, which is what you have to do when somebody dies, means that you can let it go. Your marriage, your relationship can become a sort of memory, but it doesn't live alongside you, informing everything you do in the here and now. And that's what successful grieving does.
Right. What enables somebody to let go then? So you said there's a process, so the grieving process. What are people doing in order to let go of some of those angry feelings when it's a relationship breakdown versus a death?
Yeah, what they're doing is understanding their relationship fully. It might sound a bit crazy. Why wouldn't you understand your relationship? I think you can sometimes have an intellectual understanding of something, but you don't really kind of feel it. And it's about allowing yourself to have all those feelings and not short-circuiting them. A lot of people find the feelings understandably so painful, you just want to throw yourself into everything, anything but feeling the feelings. And it's about allowing yourself to feel them until that you're spent with them. And it's also really, really important not to give all the power and potency and agency to your ex-partner. You know, I hear a lot of people talking about, oh, he's doing this and he's gone out with so-and-so and he's posted a picture here. And everything is about the other person. And there's an abandonment of yourself and how you feel. And you're in the center of your life, and you have to create a life for yourself. And that's part of the process of mourning and letting go.
And do you think these feelings and roles are gendered in ways, or do they rise above the gender? So is it more driven by gender, social norms, social constructs of how we behave and what's typical? Or is it driven by the idea of there's a lever and a person who's been left? And I can't decide which is the most important. It's like, is gender more important or birth order more important in, you know, what predicts the sort of personalities of siblings? I can't decide whether it's just a combination or whether there is a stronger factor in all of that.
Well, I wonder whether you're talking about how the different genders manage separation. And, you know, it's stereotypical in a way, and in a way I can't make sweeping statements. But generally, I would say that men often find somebody else very, very quickly in order to get themselves into the sort of next bit. And they don't do a lot of processing. Now, I'm not saying all men are like that, because they're really, really not. But it does happen quite a lot that men try to bypass the process, not have to face the loss, by simply putting somebody else in the position of their ex-partner. Women do it differently. Women generally, and again, I'm generalizing, feel all the feelings and are left with all the hurt and having to process it. And it takes quite a long time. So in that respect, there seems to be a gender difference. And women often leave a relationship because they've been endemically and chronically unhappy for a long time. They put a lot of thought into it. It's not happened overnight. And eventually something cracks. They say, I can't take one more step in this relationship, and they go. Men, generally, not always, put somebody in place and leave because there's somebody else lined up, and then they don't have to sort of worry about all the things that then you have to worry about when you're left and you're on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were talking about loneliness inside a relationship earlier, and I just wanted to circle back to that because I think it's a really important point. What's happening to the relationship if one or both people are feeling that disconnected and that lonely within a relationship? What's going on? What do you hear?
Something has gone missing. Something's got lost. And often when you have children, people are so busy putting everything into the family unit and running about and doing things for their children that they forget to connect in a sort of romantic or intimate way, and they forget to feed this third entity, as I refer to it, called the couple, between the relationship between them. And, you know, I think it can happen both ways and something gets lost. And so if people feel there's something left to be worked with, they can have some couples therapy and learn how to reconnect and refeed the relationship. And I think it's really, really important in couples to keep a dialogue going all the time about your needs, your feelings, your responses, and to keep some kind of intimate romantic connection, because you're co-parents if you've got children, but you're also a couple, and it's the couple that get lost. And often it's sort of too late if it's gone on for too long, too many years.
Yes, we hear that a lot. People who, you know, on the surface look like a really good couple because they've got everything organized. You know, they're ferrying their kids around, doing all the stuff, working out the home. They've got the, you know, the money coming in. They've ticked all the boxes essentially, but they're just, like you say, there's just nothing left, or no time, no energy, no spirit left for the relationship and nurturing of that relationship. And like you say, it's sometimes it's gone on for a very long time. Is it possible to get that back?
Yes, I think with good intentions, and it has to be from two people. It has to be. And people often make the sort of mistake, because they're in pain, of thinking that it can be unilateral. You know, I can do this, I can give her or him this, I can say this, and I will get him or her back. It has to be two-way. You can't sell yourself, because a relationship is relational. It's not unilateral.
So essentially, it's kind of the principle of lowest common denominators. If one person is out, not prepared to try, essentially that's the end of the relationship then.
Yeah, because a relationship is two people.
That's quite hard, isn't it, then, actually being able to come to a point of acceptance, even if you're the person who wants to keep it going. If the other person is very clear that the relationship is over, then essentially it's over, isn't it?
Well, that's the most painful thing. But then if you're trying to keep something alive when the other person is making it clear that they're not interested, you have to look at why you want to sort of get blood out of a stone, why you want to have something from somebody who's not giving it to you. And that comes back to self-worth again, and feeling very lonely, because you're not connecting with yourself, so you're being lonely.
And there's something about the acceptance of it being over, isn't there? Something about just being able to hear the other person. Because I hear a lot from, you know, people who are coming through us where they say, if I could just make them listen, or it's just a phase they're going through, it's, you know, they'll be back on track and it's just a bumpy patch. And I guess one of the hardest things for some people to discern is whether their relationship is hitting a rough patch or whether it's genuinely beyond repair. And that's quite a tricky space to navigate, isn't it? I mean, where do you start with that?
Well, I've heard so many people, so many women say, oh, he's having a midlife crisis because he's gone off with somebody else. Well, he's not having a midlife crisis. He's elected to go off with somebody else. And it's about, through a lot of pain, but accepting that and not devaluing yourself by going after somebody who's saying, I don't want you.
I increasingly hear as well a lot of, on the other sort of side of it, because we talk a lot more about menopause and the change that women go through in sort of midlife, I hear a lot more now about men worrying that their wives are going through the menopause and that is what's happening, rather than it being a genuine disconnect or breakdown of the relationship. So again, a new one to kind of navigate. Is that something that you have experience of?
There are all sorts of reasons that people give for why their partner no longer wants to be with them. And it can be hormonal, it can be age-related, career-related. There is a whole myriad of reasons. But the bottom line is, if somebody is saying, either in words or deeds, I don't want to be with you, that's when the work starts. Mm. How do you look after yourself?
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things that people often ask is, can you do this kind of relationship therapy on your own? Well, I guess the answer to that is you can prepare yourself to leave and you can work with a partner or work with the concept of somebody who's left you, but you can't repair the relationship unless two people are sitting in the room.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, of course.
You can do a lot of work by yourself, understanding yourself and understanding how this has all happened, and then sort of getting yourself back upright. It's very hard. Post-separation, in a new separation, just having separated, it's very hard to think. You know, that sounds like a funny thing, but there are a lot of feelings and not much thinking. And everything is experienced through a filter of sort of paranoia and fragility and feeling like the world is against you. So at that very moment in time, it's very hard to actually think in a creative way and think in a way that actually gets you somewhere, because you're flooded with feelings.
So that middle bit of the brain where all the feeling centers are is being the powerful kind of agent at that point, isn't it? And that frontal part of your brain that's normally got the rational control thinking side, that's being overwhelmed. And you're in that series of feelings, aren't you? It feels right, therefore it must be right. And that's kind of the driving momentum of how you're operating at that point. And I think you're right, somehow trying to create some space so that you can activate that frontal part of your brain to put planning and the control and the appropriate filters back in. That can be one of the things that's really key to successfully negotiating all this sort of practical stuff you've got to do alongside the emotional journey that you may be going through.
That's right. It's quite helpful sometimes when you're flooded with feeling to write your feelings down and to sort of look at them, because then that activates the thinking part of your brain and you can actually physically see your feelings, and that makes your thinking bigger and your feelings smaller.
Yes. And that sounds like a really good tip, because it's very much what you're having to do. And we sort of live in a society, don't we, where we're entitled to feel how we feel, and you can have these feelings, whatever they are, and they're all valid and they're all accepted, and that's absolutely fine. But when you've got a job to do, for example, negotiating a divorce settlement, running through the co-parenting arrangements for children, whatever that is, you've got to be able to employ those thinking strategies as well as the emotional feeling strategies as well, which are more linked to longer term healing.
It is an irony that at the time that you have to do your most amount of thinking.
Yes, strategic work, yes.
Strategic work and make sensible decisions for yourself and your future, it's the time that it's most difficult to do it.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask you that about timing. So when we're helping people go through a divorce process or a separation process, we're doing all of the practical things like filing paperwork with the court, doing the legal unpicking of the marriage, looking at how people are going to separate finances. Is that the right time to be doing the individual work? Is there a right time, or is it just too individual, and are there pros and cons?
I think there's different work at different times. If somebody comes to see me and they're newly separated and they're in a very bad way, it's just a space to talk about your feelings, to just get them out, to sort of dump them in a way. A bit further down the line, you can start to think more about what do you need? Where do I need to get to? How do I manage this? What do I do when? But the immediate aftermath is the most painful bit. And that's when it's hard to think. But that doesn't mean work can't be done. It's just a different type of work.
Well, sometimes you don't get the luxury of choice about when these processes start, do you? So, you know, in an ideal world, we always say to people who try and give your partner some time to adjust, if you're the person telling the other person that you want the separation or the divorce, give them some time. And that's fine. But sometimes life doesn't work in such a neat, prescribed way, does it? So sometimes we're faced with people who are having to deal with some of the technicalities of separating assets or going through the divorce process when the emotions are still raw. So what would you advise in those circumstances? What can people do to try and be as able and aware as they possibly can in a sort of practical way?
I always say to people that there's no immediate call to action, that because you're separated, whether you've left or been left, you don't have to act on it immediately. You have to let the dust settle a little bit. And I think when you're left, or you've done the leaving and you just want it done, you rush to divorce, you rush to file papers, you rush to do this.
How does that work with children then? So if you are separating and you've got children in the mix and you separate, and I guess you're physically separating, there has to be some discussions with children. That how does that work? What do you normally advise people in those circumstances?
Well, you have to do the basics. You have to allow the children to move between the two separate households if people have moved out. And you have to have a basic structure in place. Now, a lot of people can do that in a very collaborative way. A lot of people can say, well, you know, you have them on these days and I'll have them on these days. And can you pick up from school and those things? Some people can't because one or both people are very uncooperative. A lot of hurt feelings get played out through the children. Children get used as pawns, and you can't see Jimmy, or you can't, because that's the way I'm showing you how angry I am. But if you can just get a little basic structure in place and hold in mind all the time that it's really, really vital that the children have a relationship with both parents, unless there's something terrible happening, of course, but that the children need to be with both parents, that's how they'll make relationships when they grow up. And also, a lot of times it's about managing your feelings about your children going to stay for the weekend or a night with the other parent. And you're so used to having them all the time yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when the loneliness thing can really kick in, can't it? Where you realize that your sort of how you value yourself is very wrapped up in your children or the fact that you're there most of the time for them and that kind of stuff. So I imagine that's quite tricky territory for people.
That's very tricky, this idea that they're gone and therefore you collapse rather than they're gone. Great, I've got 48 hours to go and do something for myself. I'll go and have a drink, I'll go to the gym, I'll just sit and blob in front of the telly without somebody asking where my socks are, that sort of thing. So it's about reframing everything and not feeling that you've been sort of left marginalized on the sidelines while the other parent's having a great time with your children. It's about valuing yourself to the point where you say, I'm actually going to have a nice time now. I know they'll come back in 48 hours or 2 days, and therefore I'm going to really do something nice now.
I guess that comes back to what you were saying before about if you've wrapped up your identity in your kids or being a mother or a father and you haven't got that self-worth, that's when it must be particularly painful and difficult, because if you're whole sort of identity is wrapped up in motherhood, for example, and you're without your children, what's left?
Yeah, but that's exactly right.
Yeah, and that's where the loneliness comes from. That's where you need to go back and revisit your own self-identity, your own self-worth, and build that up from the bottom so that those weekends or weeks in the summer become opportunities, not painful, bleak spots.
That's right. Developing a self. You know, which is sometimes very lacking in a relationship.
And this idea of loneliness, we know we talk about it when people have moved out, so they're separated and it's obvious then you have to talk to the children about moving between two homes. When you're at that point of deciding to separate and everybody's still in the same home and you are perhaps at your most lonely because in your mind you are no longer a couple, but externally you are still living a couple life. How do you deal with that? And do kids pick up on that kind of thing? Can they sniff out that loneliness and that lack of connection between their adults?
Well, I think children are very hypervigilant. They have sort of radar, sonic and visual. They pick up on things, on cues. And I don't know whether you're talking about when people haven't actually decided between themselves, it's just going wrong between them, but they haven't actually made the decision. I think children do pick up, unless you're very good at masking things. But the idea of when you tell your children and how you tell them is about putting a plan in place between the two of you as parents, and then hopefully reading from a common collaborative script. But until then, you know, you have to make sure your children don't really pick stuff up until you're ready to tell them what's happening.
So that was a really useful summary, Charlotte. Thank you. If we're looking at helping people maybe decide to go for some therapy or looking at the sort of work they can do when they've decided to separate and they're in the early stages, what sort of tips would you be telling people at this point in time, at the early stages?
But if you're overwhelmed with feeling, if things feel really difficult. It's hard to sleep, hard to eat, hard to concentrate, hard to keep it all together. Go and talk to somebody because it's helpful. And if you feel not ready, and if you feel further down the line, you're very stuck, you cannot get over it. Not that you should get over it in a particular amount of time, but that you're stuck in that you're preoccupied with what your ex-partner is doing or saying or how he's being or she's being, you may need some help to help you in that grieving process so that you grieve successfully and you can separate, you can emotionally separate and be part of your own life and in the center of your own life rather than in the margins of your ex-partner's life.
That's a really good way of putting it, isn't it? And then it doesn't matter what other practical things are going on in parallel. That's a journey you need to complete anyway, isn't it? So irrespective of whether the divorce is at the beginning, middle and end, or end in terms of the legal process or the sorting out the kids or the finances, that's work that is an investment in yourself and your onward life. And it sounds super important that people take the time to cover that and heal.
It's very important work. And it's also important in terms of, although you won't be thinking this at the time you're separating, if you ever want to have a relationship in the future that's a better one, that's a good one, that gives you what you need, you might need to do some work on yourself to understand why you accepted less than you should have done.
Excellent. On that note, Charlotte, all it remains for me to say is thank you very much for joining me today. If people are interested in finding out more about this, where can they find you?
I have a website, divorcesupportgroup.co.uk, but the book Breaking Upwards, How to Manage the Emotional Impact of Separation, may be helpful.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Don't forget, you can download this podcast on your favourite streaming site. You can find me on X. I'm at Kate_Daly. And you can also find more about this podcast and other episodes by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. Thank you, Charlotte. And thank you, everybody, for listening.